Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Chris Scully.
And I'm Michelle. Today we'll hear from the farmer Ben Schwartz and Tom Ross of Sane Energy Project, who are opposing the Cricket Valley fracked gas power plant from being opened in Dover, New York.
Then we'll hear an interview with musician Hannah Mayry about the Black Banjo Reclamation Project.
And later on, we'll hear the latest installment of Women in STEM.
And after that, J.J. Luceno and Dr. Frank Coughlin discuss their upcoming Nature Lab workshop.
Finally, we'll hear a discussion with poet and community activist D.D. Delgado about decentering the privileged in community organizing.
But first, some headlines. A New York law that is intended to protect children from convicted sex offenders has created a maze of contradictory policies and regulations, leading to inconsistent enforcement and confusing online tracking systems, according to the Times Union. The disparities have also resulted in sharply different residency requirements for offenders convicted of similar crimes and an increasing perplexity to the system that makes it difficult for the public to confirm whether offenders in their area are in compliance.
Bolivia President Evo Morales, a member of the indigenous population, has resigned due to rising violence and pressure from the military. Worldwide governments condemned the coup. Supporters of Evo Morales have flooded the streets, demanding an overturning of the right-wing coup. Bolivia coup backers are burning the Wapahala flag, a symbol of indigenous resistance. The global demand for lithium, used to make batteries for cell phones, laptops, and hybrid cars, is expected to triple in the next 15 years. 50 to 70% of the world's supply is in Bolivia's Unisalt flats.
A federal judge in Buffalo on Friday dismissed a lawsuit filed by Erie County Clerk that sought to halt New York's quote-unquote green light law, which allows undocumented immigrants to apply for driver's licenses. According to the Times Union, the decision doesn't address the merits of the law, but determined the clerk lacked legal standing to challenge it.
The State Education Department reports that Troy's School 2 in North Central Troy has made significant improvements since it was placed under observation in July 2015. The school, located in one of Troy's poorest neighborhoods, met the state's target of 10 of 11 categories last year, including a reduction in achievement gaps, graduation rates, student attendance, suspension rates, student safety, and parent and family engagement.
Representative Peter King, a Republican who has represented a Long Island congressional district for nearly 30 years, announced Monday that he will not seek re-election. King, 75, currently serves on the House Homeland Security and Financial Services Committees. To date, almost two dozen Republicans have announced that they are retiring from the lower chamber, resigning, or running for other offices.
On Tuesday, Supreme Court justices will hear oral arguments in cases triggered by Trump's move to end Obama-era protections for undocumented immigrants under the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. The cases are at the heart of a political fight and could impact more than 700,000 people. A ruling is expected next summer, just months before the 2020 election.
An arrest by Albany by University at Albany police, captured in a cell phone video last week, is sparking protests and campus-wide discussion on race and police aggression toward people of color. At least seven officers can be viewed in the footage apprehending non-student Ali Mohammed Sanou, 19, who was arrested in the university's campus center. Sanou was charged with offenses including false impersonation, resisting arrest, harassment, and drug charges, according to the university police crime logs. For those just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York.
To learn more about this program and the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org.
Climate activists are urging Governor Cuomo to stop the Cricket Valley fracked gas power plant from being opened in Dover, New York, which is southeast of Poughkeepsie. A community rally in opposition will be held Saturday, November 16th at 11 a.m. at the plant. We speak with local farmer Ben Schwartz and Tom Ross of Sane Energy Project.
Talking with Ben Schwartz, who's an area farmer, and there's been a lot of local concern raised about this power plant called Cricket Valley. Ben, what are some of the concerns that residents have about this particular power plant?
First off, residents are concerned about their kids, just because the middle school, high school, and elementary school are all within less than a mile of the plant, and the plant does have a lot of emissions that are coming out. Another concern is the swamp, the Great Swamp, which contains the Swamp River, which the plant is built on. There's a lot of concern about acidifying of the swamp due to the sulfuric acid that's being emitted by the plant. There's also a lot of concern about lack of consent from local communities. The plant borders on Western Connecticut, which already has a lot of air problems. A lot of the towns in Western Connecticut are up in arms because they didn't know about the plant till last year. Meanwhile, the plant had been passed by the Department of Environmental Conservation of New York State in 2011.
So 2011, that would have still have been Governor Andrew Cuomo. What are you trying to get the governor and others to do about the plan at this point? I understand they're trying to open it in a few months.
I would say follow their Andrew Cuomo's own legislation. There was a bill passed in the New York State Senate just a few months ago that said that we need to get off all net zero fossil fuels by 2040. There's no way that a 1,100 megawatt fracked gas power plant with, you know, millions of tons of emissions every year is going to fit within this legislation that Andrew Cuomo signed. So I would ask him to shut down the plant or at least do stop the plant and do a study on how this is going to fit into our net zero emissions by 2040 plan that New York State government passed.
Now, you mentioned, or I mentioned you were a farmer. What are some of the, you know, agriculture impacts of trying to open this facility?
Well, there's a lot of impacts. I mean, farming is difficult as it is. We are concerned about the acidification of our soil. Being that small farming is difficult, many of our area farmers depend on agrotourism. And this fossil fuel plant is very ugly. It also pollutes the air. And we're many farms in the area are very concerned that people are not going to want to come to the Harlem Valley after they put this plant up. The whole point, for example, New York City tourism is to get out of the city. And when you look at these huge smokestacks, you're going to want to go somewhere else.
Now, this is a plant a little bit south and, I guess, east of Poughkeepsie, Kingston, Newburgh, down along the Connecticut-New York border?
Yeah, correct. It's on the very eastern side of Dutchess County, so in between the Hudson Valley and Connecticut.
I've certainly seen a lot of emails in the last year about, you know, opposition to Cricket Valley. What's been, you know, any movement from the governor? What are the local governments urging the governor to do on this?
The governor was asked about Cricket Valley. He said that he hadn't heard of it, which to me means that he wants people to come out and show that they're very concerned about it so they can hear about it, and then he will take action. So we're organizing to do that now.
I understand you're having a rally coming up in next weekend?
Yeah, so November 16th is going to be a family-friendly rally at 11 a.m. in front of the plant, which is on Route 22 in between the Harlem Valley Wingdale train station and the Dover High School. We invite everyone to come out. It's going to be a great time. There's going to be also be some other direct action stuff going on, so we're excited about just bringing people out for a fun family affair with music, food, and just to learn more and to show your face and show that you're concerned and interested in our environment.
And if people want to just find out more about Cricket Valley, do you have a Facebook page or something they can go get some background information?
Absolutely. There's the Facebook page is Stop Cricket Valley. There's a New York, and there's one for Connecticut as well. And then there's also, I believe, stopcricketvalley.com, I believe. So there's a website as well.
Thank you very much, Ben Schwartz. So next we catch up with Tom Ross, who, among other groups, has been working with the St. Energy Project. Tom, I know people are concerned about Cricket Valley as well as many other fossil fuel power plants. Why do we need to get the governor to shut down these fossil fuel infrastructure?
I think the most important reason is that they constitute a real barrier toward the state attaining its goals for renewable development as well as emissions control.
You know, and it seems that the governor has been willing to push the envelope a little bit on trying to expand the transition to renewable energy, but even though he said no more fracking of natural gas in New York, he still seems quite open to allowing it to be imported from Pennsylvania and elsewhere.
I think that being a political figure and having to be subject to pressure and influence, as well as satisfying the incentives of a number of different constituencies, we can understand how someone who's in the position of the governor would be subject to such pressures. That's understandable. However, we as citizens need to support the governor being able to take better positions that actually, in my belief, reflect his internal conscience and sense of vision and conviction about the direction the state needs to go in. And that holds true for any of the political figures in the Assembly, in the Senate. To my mind, one of the things that really has to happen, that has to happen more, that used to happen way back in the days, but hasn't happened in a long time, is that outside politics and inside politics need to find a way to work together. We need to support the people in Albany so that they can feel like there's people behind them, so that they can do the right thing and have support on that. And they can support us to implement things that are implementable pragmatically in the present as we move forward toward the future. That kind of synergy between inside and outside is politics. And I say that as a political outsider who would never conceive of myself of running for office. I think it's very important. And the antagonism between inside and outside politics, I think, can be really problematic.
Well, how do one overcome the little problem that President Trump seems almost to be a climate change denier? How do you, I knew when Greta Thunberg came to the United States and was asked that question, she said, well, in Europe, we don't have climate deniers, so I don't know how you respond to a climate denier. But how do you bring together the polarization in the United States or even New York State at this point around, say, climate change?
I think you have to do that by having a democratic vision, which includes people's concerns about a lot of different issues, not only climate change, but issues related to it, but are also outside of it. Like, for instance, the way that it must be taken as a given that the fossil fuel industry fuels a lot of the activity in our economy. So when people talk about that displacing like a fundamental part of their way of life, they're right. So we who are concerned about those things need to have the vision, like Pete Seeger says, the ability to imagine, use our imaginations to think about the impossible. But what that means is to find a way to make it possible. There's a way for people who are incentivized to, for instance, I'll use Pennsylvania as a test case, not because it's so relevant to New York, but it's where I'm from. I personally know people for whom it was a very hard choice for them to have frackers do work on their property and drill on their property. But what they were looking at was allowing that to happen, signing that contract to allow the companies to come in, or not being able to feed their family, being sick and tired of working at Walmart 12 hours a day, chopping wood for their neighbors and doing odd plumbing jobs for their neighbors on Saturdays and Sundays. They saw that steady stream of income and they said, here's a government that's not doing anything for me. It's sending my jobs overseas. What else can I do? We need to have the vision and the breadth of vision to be able to embrace concerns of people for all walks of life, from all from all different areas, economic concerns, civil rights concerns, environmental concerns. That's why it's important to democratize the movement. So it's not only the synergy of inside and outside, it's also the intersectionality of the politics. And I don't just mean intersectionality with political correctness. I mean genuine, hard intersectionality that comes from talking to people that we don't agree with on many things, so that they can realize the things that we have in common and move forward as a democratic front to make those changes against the people at the top, like Trump, who in fact are using this dissension among working class people to their advantage.
We're out of time. This has been Tom Ross with Sane Energy Project. This has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
And that was local farmer Ben Schwartz and Tom Ross of Sane Energy Project opposing the opening of a fracked gas power plant in Dover Plains, New York.
Musician Hannah Mayry sat down with WOC producer Melissa Bromley to play a tune, discuss what drives her, and tell us about the Black Banjo Reclamation Project.
I am Hannah Mayry of the Black Banjo Reclamation Project, and this is a song called Home.
My name is Hannah Mayry. Hello.
And tell us about yourself.
There's definitely a lot to say, but
Music is one of the things that I do amongst other things. I'm from California, mm-hmm. and I'm on a trip right now to the East Coast this month, and it's visiting a lot of friends and family, being on an ancestral journey, as well as a water journey and a banjo journey as well. And all of those things are connected in terms of, in my life, just being dedicated to reclaiming and being in touch with traditional ways of my ancestors and the healing that has to be done, that so much is accessible through music as well as through traditional medicine, bringing back traditional birth ways, all of which I deal with in my life in California. I've been living in the Bay Area, and I'm from Sacramento, and coming out here is just one more step on the journey.
So it sounds like you are using art and music and other ways and means in your life to on a spiritual journey. Is that?
Absolutely.
And can you tell me more about the different outlets that you have?
Definitely. So over the last few years, I've been, I did record an album a few years ago that is currently available for folks online. And that was a really good basis and a really good platform for me to start on. I started to play the banjo. I never had my hands on a banjo before about 10 years ago. And it was actually, interestingly enough, in Western New York that I did actually get exposed to that for myself for the first time. And this was around the time when there was just really starting to be, in our sort of current day and age, more popularity in the banjo and access to the banjo through a Black lens and through an Afrocentric vision that was really looking at the concept of Sankofa and going back and getting these what could some might consider a lost art form. The banjo is an African-derived instrument that many people associate with
white culture,
like white rural culture of, in a lot of ways. And so for me, I'm really glad that I was able to find this medicine and to find this for myself. And so that's really why that's what's allowed me to like have a voice in music and to make a space for myself to do that. Me personally, that was not enough. And it was something that I wanted to be able to bring to more people and create more access around the banjo and other folk instruments. So I did create the Black Banjo Reclamation Project last year, which has been accepting and donating banjos in the form of reparations. And I think I'll just read a small snippet from that so people could hear.
Sure.
That's all about.
Yeah, so that's the Black Banjo Reclamation Project.
This was written by myself and a really amazing artist, Nia Amina, who's in Seattle, for a show that we did. It says, Black folk tradition is the site of memory and resilience in which the music cannot be separated from the context under which it was created. For the banjo, a historically violent past maps the instrument's complex and troubled journey. Colonization to slavery, minstrelsy through Jim Crow, the banjo has been deceptively romanticized and separated from its Pan-African roots. To reclaim this history, the Black Banjo Reclamation Project builds and redistributes banjos, gourd banjos, and other African instruments, returning earth-based indigenous practices back to the Black community. In spite of displacement and dispossession, we retain our music and culture to create a sense of self, a sense of unity, a sense of home, and most importantly, to take back power.
So that's amazing. You are bringing banjo to Black communities in the U.S.?
Yes. We do recognize that this is a banjo has been spread across the diaspora. So there's a lot of folks in the South and South American regions, islands, Caribbean, as well as people who are on the African continent who have been engaging in this music for a long time. And through some of the means that we just mentioned, that has not really made it into a lot of sort of the popular ways that we express ourselves through string instruments, including the fiddle and whatnot. And, you know, this all of the instruments that we're talking about also refer to drumming and whatnot, things that have given us life for so many generations that it has been systematically taken away from these communities. And so we already see that disparity happening on every other level. This is just one more. So we have been doing a lot of different programming for a lot of different communities to be able to share this and to look at the healing that we need to do and really be able to bring the conversation up and say, why is it that most of the time that I'm seeing this instrument played, or in general these instruments played, it's by white people? And how did they come to get that? And was it actually in right relationship with what's going on in our world? So we want to ask those questions. And like, we're actually in the region where Pete Seeger did a lot of work, so there's a lot of folks who are probably familiar with his work and his banjo playing and him being a water protector. And these are all the types of things that we're considering and we're looking at from many different cultural views and bringing people into the conversation, into the work.
That's great. So we have just a few seconds left. Can you tell our listeners how they can find your music and how they can support the Black Banjo Reclamation Project?
Definitely. If you want to check out our website, you can go to blackbanjoreclamationproject.org. You can find me on Instagram at Reverse the Diaspora. And I also have social media and music under the name Hannah Mae Ree, which is spelled M-A-Y-R-E-E.
That was musician Hannah Mae Ree speaking about the Black Banjo Reclamation Project.
For those just tuning in, I'm Chris Kelly.
And I'm Michelle. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and find out about the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or a sour bone to pick, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
Nature Lab intern Sophia K. Helene speaks to Professor Heidi Newberg about her research in astrophysics and being a woman in STEM.
So this is Sophia K. Helene, and I am here with Professor Heidi Newberg from Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, where she researches and teaches astrophysics. Welcome.
Yeah, it's nice to be here.
So I wanted to just start off with basic questions about the sciences and kind of how you originally got interested in STEM, or physics in particular.
Okay. I think what I liked as a kid was figuring things out. So I liked these brain teasers, and there were Scientific American, you know, mind builders, and I would try to do all of the puzzles that I possibly could do. And I think that's really what excites me about the sciences, the puzzle aspect of it. And I never really picked astronomy or physics ahead of time.
Yeah.
It just sort of is what happened when I started. In your senior year, all of a sudden someone asks you what you want to do next, and that's when you first start thinking about it. And I thought, well, maybe I'll do something science and math. And my father, who went to school in the 60s and got an undergraduate degree in psychology, said, well, if you're going to do math or physics, you should do engineering so that you can get a job. And so I did that. I went to RPI as a freshman in mechanical engineering. And when I was there for a year, I thought, you know, I really don't want to take the sophomore level engineering classes. I didn't want to take lumped parameter systems. I didn't want to take fluid dynamics. Mm-hmm. And I realized that what I wanted to know was why everything worked the way it did and not how do I use the way things work. And I think that's kind of the difference between scientists and engineers. You know, we do the same, we use the same concepts and the same physics, but as a scientist, you're always asking, well, why does metal stretch when you pull on it? And when you're an engineer, you want to know, how does it stretch so I can build my bridge?
Yep. And how can I use this?
And so that's when I switched into physics.
Okay, cool. So you mentioned you went to RPI.
Yes.
And so that was undergrad?
Yes.
Did you stay there for graduate school?
No, I didn't. I did my graduate work at University of California, Berkeley.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so I mean, there's not too many times, I thought, you know, there's not too many times in your life when you can just pick up and go across the country and try something new. Mm. And I had done my undergraduate work very close to where I grew up. So this was a chance to just go out and see the world.
Yeah.
Going to the West Coast.
Yeah. Okay. So can you tell the world of your specific subject area right now? So astrophysics, what are you working on in your research?
Well, I actually am working on too many things at the same time, is the real answer to that question. My main area of research is the Milky Way galaxy, trying to understand the structure of the Milky Way galaxy and how it formed, how it became the way it is today, how it works. When I started learning about galaxies in school, it was always kind of a static picture. You would draw a picture of an exponential disk and then some kind of halo it was in, and it just seemed like everything was just static. And what we're finding is that small galaxies are falling into the Milky Way, so they're things that are coming in all the time. Yeah. Smaller galaxies.
Small galaxies.
And they're perturbing the disk stars, and so they actually could be making spiral structures or affecting the whole organic shape of the galaxy. So I now think of the Milky Way as this dynamic place where there's all these things falling in and dust being blown out and spiral arms forming and changing, and it's a whole dynamic system. And so I'm trying to understand how that whole system works.
Yeah.
And one of the big things that we think about is that like 80% of all the mass in our galaxy is dark matter, which is a substance that we have no idea what it is.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that we try to use is the dynamics of that Milky Way galaxy to try to understand something about the dark matter that we cannot see, and you know, try to figure out exactly where it is in the galaxy.
Okay.
So that's the main thing.
You know, just giant structures in space. It's pretty intense. Okay. Moving away more from the science bit and into being a woman in STEM, and I was wondering if you had ever experienced from peers in the field or students unconscious or implicit biases?
Well, I mean, we all experience those, right? And a lot of times it's difficult to know that that's actually what's going on. You never know when you weren't chosen to do something or you weren't asked to do something. Mm-hmm. You don't know what the real reason was. And it's only kind of when you think back on your whole career that you kind of see how little things shape what happens in your career. I've written a couple things about it that are on my website from different points in my career, and I think at different career stages people think about how things happen differently. I think as an undergraduate student, I just didn't think about it. I mean, maybe things did happen. Looking back on it, I can see that people said things or things did happen, but it didn't really affect me. And it wasn't until I was in graduate school that I started to really understand that some people would see me as a person who was going to become a scientist, and some people would see me as somebody who probably cares more about kids than science, and you know, is not going to stick with it.
Yeah.
And it becomes a lot more obvious the farther you go up in your career. And I think that, you know, it's not, you know, men or women, or I think it's just as common for women to stop other women's careers as for men. And you see it in, for example, undergraduate student teaching evaluations. They've done study after study, and the same teacher, the same teaching style, the same grades on every other performance metric will give a lower grade for women or a lower for people that are minorities.
Wow.
And if you're both, it's really bad.
Yeah.
But it's across the board, all ages, all genders, mm-hmm. That you have to just keep reminding yourself that that can't stop you anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you, so kind of leading off of that, have you experienced imposter syndrome kind of from that almost, or just?
You know, I actually don't. I know a lot of people do. I have always felt like I really never got anything that I didn't deserve three times over.
Nice. No, that's great.
You know, maybe I stopped myself maybe from even going to where I should have been. Maybe, you know, my own, you know, being unsure of myself, maybe I never put myself in a situation where I would be an imposter. I don't know. But I don't think anyone ever encouraged me to do anything I wasn't so qualified for. It was ridiculous. So, no, I have never felt like an imposter.
That's good. I mean, I don't think enough people don't feel like an imposter, if that makes sense. So one last question before we're out of time. Do you have a message that you might want to share with young girls or others who might be interested in STEM or physics?
Yeah, I think that women worry too much about what'll happen when they go down one track or another. Will I be able to have children? Will I be able to have hobbies? Will I be able to live my life? And I think what I would say is just don't worry about it. You just do it. And I always kind of felt like I could leave at any time. I mean, if you're walking the STEM pathway and you decide that the pathway you're on is not something you want to do, you can always do something else. I mean, you always have skills and options and you can try to do other things. But I think one of the problems is if you limit yourself. You know, if you say, I don't know if I want to do that because I'm afraid of what will happen if I do. Mm-hmm. And I think you should just go for it and see what happens. I mean, it's not going to be a problem.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for coming down to do this interview.
And thank you, Sophia, for another great installment of Women in STEM. If you want to learn more about the series, check out Sophia Cahalane's People Power page on the Sanctuary's website, www.mediasanctuary.org/peoplepower.
Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Branda Miller welcomed J.J. Lucino and Dr. Frank Coghlan to the studio to discuss their upcoming Nature Lab workshop. The Health Autonomy Clinic, Session 1, will occur on Tuesday, November 12th at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. This first session of HAC will consist of a socialization period between health professionals and the community, as well as a brainstorming group, so that HAC becomes the best it can be. Come to the Sanctuary on Tuesday, November 12th at 4 p.m.
Hi. Today we are welcoming two people in the studio who will be doing a workshop with Nature Lab this Tuesday, November 12th, the Health Autonomy Clinic. Thank you, J.J. Lucino and Dr. Frank Coghlan, for joining us today.
Thank you.
Welcome. So we're going to be talking about a health autonomy clinic, and the idea is to establish some kind of space in Troy. So this is really, this first session is about brainstorming. What is a health autonomy clinic?
Yeah, thanks for having us. This is really great, and we're excited for the future collaboration with the Sanctuary for Independent Media. You know, the idea of the health autonomy clinic is really more than just a space and more than just a clinic. I think one of the things that we have found, myself, I work as an ER doctor in Western Mass and soon in Troy, is that it's clear that our health system is failing people, even for people who have health insurance. We're looking at the percentage of medical bankruptcies that happen, and also just the way that Western medicine kind of objectifies the body is clearly not promoting health. It may eliminate some diseases, and has proven to be useful at times, but as far as like holistic community health is not where we want to go. And as we look to the future with climate change and with, you know, political unrest and growing inequality in the world, it's clear that a large segment of population will not have access to health systems, but also that health systems are not going to be able to answer the questions that we have for the future as far as holistic health. And so this idea of a health autonomy clinic as a starting point is a space for us to kind of imagine what an autonomy in health would be. And, you know, we mean this in the sense of not just that only holistic medicines and non-Western medicines will heal us, but this idea of what it is it that we actually need from health systems, how can we manipulate those health systems and take what we need from them as a way to grow and organize our communities together in a way of community health. It's also a space that we want to work on this idea of deprofessionalizing medicine, that medicine is not just, or health is not just the forum of those who went to a lot of school, but also this idea of like grandmother's knowledge that, you know, people have been staying healthy for thousands, tens of thousands of years. And there has been a huge effort to delegitimize those practices. And so we want to create a space that those practices and those ways of thinking can be seen as a legitimate, but also as a way of creating a more holistic health experience.
And I would add to that we think of autonomy not in this sense of self-independence or self-reliance, but rather this idea that these support systems are deeply rooted in our connectedness to others, and being able to know that, wow, this person has this skill and lives two blocks down from me, and creating a space where people can actually find those connections within their own block or their own neighborhood or their own city. And I think right now in the age that we're living in, we hear a lot about self-care and about having these practices for yourself, but often those practices are based on you needing to buy something. You need to buy a yoga class to be healthy. You need different shoes to be healthy. You need to drink this new elixir to be healthy. And we know that's not true. We know that these skills lie within us. And I think this idea of health autonomy is a way to reconnect with those skills, whether it's learning about elder care or grief work or talking to somebody who is also experiencing challenges of being a mother and raising children. And so it's actually about self-care in a way that is far more radical and liberatory, rather than just buying something that will at the end of the day not necessarily take care of that part of you.
And you both come from a radical healthcare community and field. Who are you? How do you bring your, I mean, I know that you're a teacher and you're a filmmaker and you're a creative entrepreneur and JJ, and I know Frank, you're a doctor. How did you come together to work on this vision for an autonomous health?
Sure. So we had a very funny way of both meeting each other. We're partners as well in life and in health autonomy. And we met through this group called Doctors for Global Health, which practices what they call liberation medicine, which is deeply rooted in liberation theology. And it's a group of not just doctors, but all types of health workers and care practitioners. And I think both of our paths converged at this meeting point, because I had been involved in community health center work, and I think after a long time of struggling to find a place in healthcare that saw health issues in an intersectional way and wasn't just driven from a medical approach. I thought, oh, wow, this is amazing. I found this place that has all these wraparound services. But even as I was doing that work, I found that in the clinic themselves, people weren't asking questions about policing in the neighborhood. People weren't asking about, you know, let's talk more deeply about these mental health issues. And so I was finding that there wasn't a space to have these other types of conversations around self-care and skill building. And so through that work, and I think through both of us looking for a horizon beyond just nonprofit health, we both came to kind of this sense of liberation medicine and health autonomy.
Yeah, and I came through medicine, you know, very influenced by the history of, I think, you know, medicine and physicians of this idea that usually it was a physician or some type of health professional who was actually the radical, like the revolutionary. You look at Che or Allende, Virchow, some other folks who have really made made history in that regard around health, but then also being very influenced by groups that Doctors for Global Health were influenced, specifically the Zapatistas, and this idea of creating health autonomy from like healthcare from below, and creating a world in which a million worlds can live. And so, you know, I was very influenced by that in my professional career, but then very disappointed by what was offered by, you know, modern medicine and careers and, you know, paying off your school debt. And so we have been trying as a collective to reinvigorate this idea, this very old historical idea that care is intrinsically holistic and intrinsically communal, and that it has been taken from us. And so this is the work that we're doing to take it back.
So on Tuesday, November 12th, you will have a community conversation. Who do you call out for? Who would you like to come and join you? And what will we be doing with you?
Yeah, we would love anyone who has ever taken care of another person, who has needed some type of care themselves, and really thinking about health in the most broad sense of the word. So people from the community, people who have licensed experience, people who have non-licensed experience, anyone who'd be interested in creating a healthy and powerful community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would add to that. Oftentimes, you know, we've been organizing in the area where we live, and people come to this and say, oh no, I don't have any health skills. Like, but then as we start a conversation, this person knows how to care for, you know, their dying parent. This person has worked with kids. This person knows tons about plants. This person's an amazing cook and knows how to create huge meals to feed people. So I think that anybody who is curious and open and, like Frank said, has cared or received care is welcome to this. And I think we often find that we each have these deep-seated care skills inside of us. We've just been told that they don't count and aren't real.
And what is your hope, in a nutshell, that will come out of this community conversation?
Yeah, that we can create a central hub for these types of conversations and further organizing around health.
Right here in Troy.
Right here in Troy.
Thank you so much, JJ and Frank, for being here and for offering this opportunity for our community to brainstorm and dream of a better way. Great. For our healthcare.
Thank you.
We're so excited.
So that was Brenda Miller speaking with JJ Luceno and Dr. Frank Coughlin. Please come to the sanctuary on Tuesday, November 12th at 4 p.m. To be part of the brainstorming for the HAC.
Hudson Mohawk Magazine roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry attended Hudson Valley Community College Voices Library Lecture Series on Decentering the Privileged. The speaker was Dee DeGaldo, poet and community activist. In this two-part segment, you will hear his interview with Dee DeGaldo about her lecture on intersectional community organizing to decentralize privilege.
This is Willie Terry, your roaming labor correspondent for the Hudson Mohawk Network. And I'm here today at Hudson Valley Community College, where they're having a forum on decentering the privilege. It's really hard to be black.
And I have as my guest, Dee Dee Delgado.
Yes.
All right, how you doing, Dee?
Hi, I'm doing okay, how are you?
Now, in your talk here, you know, talking to the students here about this right here, do you think this method can be done at the college community?
I think college students are in a very unique place to actually do this kind of work because they haven't been fully indoctrinated yet. They think that they have. They think that they know all the answers. But they're on a quest right now. They go to, what is it, however many semesters per year, right? However many classes in those semesters. Mm-hmm. And their job, they have one job, is to understand what is being taught to them, to prove that they understand it. And so I'd love to be able to teach a class where I can teach this, and then folks have to prove that they understand. I think Black folks will understand it. Some Black folks might have a hard time because they'll be like, well, I don't have that experience. But then that means that it's intersectional. You might have a class privilege, or you might think that because you know, you haven't experienced violence, that it doesn't exist. But if you are taught the material, I think that you would have a better understanding of it. And I think that white students would too.
So what were some of the major points that you were trying to bring out today?
I want them to be more aware of community or community organizing that actually exists. I want them to actually be mindful of when they are in spaces, who isn't present and why. They need to be asking that question everywhere they go. If they're in a bank, they need to know that if there are only white people there, why is that? It's not because Black people don't have money, or that we don't want to know how to save, or that we don't want to buy a home, or we're not looking for credit, right? Why are white spaces white? You know, it's not because Black people are lazy. We're actually, if you know about the Black tax, we're actually one of the hardest working demographics. So, like, the Black tax is when you have to work 10 times as hard just to be seen inherently as equal as your peers, you know? So I'd like for them to walk away with that, to know that if I'm in a room, whose voice is missing here? Not just people of color. Are there people here who are trans or LGBTQ? Are there people here who are disabled? Are there people here who are cash poor when I have money? Or are there people here that actually have resources that can help us move them around, you know?
Yeah. Now, you talked a little bit about racism, too.
Yeah.
You know, so how do racism factor into this?
I feel like racism is, a lot of people don't understand it who aren't people of color, right? And so the way to best understand racism is, I have a definition that I always go by, but racism is a structural and individual oppression of people of color and non-white people by white people. And if you don't understand that, then I think of sexism, right? How it's a structural and individual oppression of women by non-women, right? And you think about classism, it's a structural and individual oppression of people who don't have money by people with money. And so that's how I think racism plays into this, is that people don't know what it is. It's like a unicorn. Reverse racism is the unicorn. People know what a unicorn looks like because someone one day said, this is what a unicorn looks like, but no one has actually seen an actual living, breathing unicorn. And so I think that Black people can have prejudice and Black people can have trepidation about working with white people, but I don't think that anything I've said is racist, because I don't have any power to exert my racism in a way that's going to affect a white person, you know? So I want people to be mindful of that too.
Now, you talked a little bit about communism, mm-hmm. In the lecture,
yes.
And some of the other isms,
right.
You know. Do you think that under capitalism that we could get rid of racism, or?
I think that capitalism and racism and class, all the isms are actually kissing cousins. That's what I think. And I think that if you eradicate all of the isms where they stem with one person, right? So, like, think of all the things you don't want to be. You don't want to be poor. Nobody wants to be Black. Paul Mooney says that, right? He's a famous comedian. He said, everybody wants to be Black until it's time to be Black, right? You know? And so I think if you were poor and you were disabled, if you were fat, right? I think about people who, do you remember the Heineken commercial where everyone was like, sit down and have a beer, like, you know, and we'll eradicate transphobia. But they had a very slender pretty looking trans woman. What does it look like when it's not societally acceptable to have a trans woman who's fat and black and, you know, doesn't have her hair? You know, Dominique Dawes can't even have her hair in a ponytail for someone hasn't upset about it. And so I think that if you were to eradicate racism, classism, it can be done. We just have to trust each other. I think that we also have to love one another enough to see each other's humanity, because that's what we're essentially saying. We're saying, be civil. I can't talk to you unless you're civil. And what does civilization really mean? NPR has a great article on what you're saying when you're telling black people and people of color to be civil. You can't get upset. You can't, you know, you're literally saying you have to be the way that my ancestors taught you how to be. And, you know, like, it's just very interesting.
Now, if someone wants to get more information about this, what suggestion would you have for them to?
I would say before you contact me, Google. Google is your friend. Read up on intersectionality. Read up on community organizing. Read up on oppression, right? And then add keywords like what I mentioned before. And then, you know, if you want to learn more, please reach out to me. I'm easily accessible. I'm on the internet, the Didi Delgado, on Facebook, on Twitter, and on Instagram. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you, Didi Delgado, the poet and the community activist.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Willie Terry and Didi, for another great discussion. And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Chris Scully.
And I'm Michelle. Our engineer tonight is the wonderful Alexis. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose on demand through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments, suggestions, or a tender confession, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
As a reminder, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in helping with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m. held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.